From Intellijix, this is Intellijix True Crime. Today, three true cases, each one investigated, tried, and closed. Let's begin. The camera was still running. That detail, as much as any other in this case, is what makes the stomach drop. Not just what was on the tape, but that he had left the camera running, as though documenting what he had done was as natural to him as anything else in his gilded, sun-drenched life. When investigators in Ventura County, California, finally sat down to watch those recordings in the early 2000s, they understood immediately that they were not looking at evidence of a crime so much as a confession, a meticulous, self-made archive of one man's belief that he was entirely beyond consequence. His name was Andrew Luster, and for a very long time, the world had given him every reason to believe that. To understand how any of this happened, you have to understand the world Andrew Luster inhabited, or rather, the world that had been handed to him. His great-grandfather was Max Factor, the Hollywood makeup artist whose name became synonymous with glamour itself, the man who literally invented the word makeup as we use it today, and built a cosmetics empire that would outlast him by generations. By the time Andrew came along in 1963, the fortune had grown into something almost abstract in its size. He did not need to work. He did not, in any conventional sense, need anything. He had a beach house in Santa Barbara, and later Malibu and the surrounding communities of Ventura County, a lifestyle built around surfing and parties and the casual, effortless social gravity that wealth provides. People were drawn to him. That was part of what made him so dangerous. The women who would eventually become the center of this case were not naive. They were not reckless. They were people living ordinary lives who crossed paths with a man who seemed charming and harmless and wealthy and fun, the kind of man who has a house on the beach and knows how to throw a party. Court records and survivor testimony would later establish a pattern that was, in retrospect, horribly consistent. A woman would meet Luster at a bar or a social gathering. She might have a drink or two. And then, according to prosecutors, she would wake up with no memory of what had happened. Disoriented, disturbed, certain that something was wrong but unable to articulate exactly what or why. That gap in memory, that stolen time, was the signature of what prosecutors would argue was a deliberate, repeated, predatory campaign. The substance at the center of it was GHB, gamma-hydroxybutyrate, a central nervous system depressant that at high doses renders a person unconscious and, crucially, destroys the memory of whatever occurred during that period of unconsciousness. It was sometimes called the date rape drug, a clinical phrase that sanitizes something profoundly ugly. Prosecutors argued that Luster had used it systematically, slipping it into drinks, waiting, and then assaulting women who were entirely helpless to resist, or even later to fully remember. The first woman to come forward, identified in court records and subsequent reporting by the pseudonym used to protect her privacy, reported her assault to police in 2000. She had met Luster at a bar, she had a few drinks. She woke up the next day in a state of profound confusion and distress, with physical evidence that something had happened to her. A rape kit was performed. Investigators began looking into Andrew Luster. And what they found when they obtained a search warrant for his home changed everything. The videotapes. There were multiple recordings, investigators found, capturing Luster sexually assaulting women who were clearly, visibly unconscious. Women who could not consent, who did not move, who were entirely unaware of what was being done to them. The tapes were not hidden in any particularly sophisticated way. They were there, in his home. And according to court records, in some of the recordings, Luster could be heard on camera, his voice audible, commenting on what he was doing. Prosecutors charged him with multiple counts of rape by use of drugs, rape of an unconscious person, and possession of GHB. As the investigation deepened, additional survivors came forward. The charges multiplied. By the time the case was fully assembled, Andrew Luster was facing 86 criminal counts, a number that reflected not a single terrible act, but a pattern, a practice, a way of operating that had apparently continued for years. He was released on bail, which, given the nature of the charges, strikes many people in retrospect as extraordinary. But Luster was wealthy and had no criminal record, and the legal process moved at its own pace. The trial began in Ventura County Superior Court in late 2002. Survivors testified. They described meeting him, the drinks, the gaps in their memory, waking up to wrongness they couldn't fully name. The videotapes were presented as evidence. Prosecutors argued that the recordings were not just damning, they were definitive. They showed, frame by frame, what Andrew Luster had done to these women while they lay unconscious and helpless in his home. And then, in January of 2003, with the trial still ongoing and the evidence arrayed against him in what most legal observers regarded as devastating fashion, Andrew Luster walked out. He had been skipping required check-ins with his bail supervisor in the weeks prior. Defense attorneys told the court they couldn't locate him. A warrant was issued for his arrest. And just like that, the heir to one of the most famous cosmetics fortunes in American history had fled, abandoning his trial, abandoning the country, leaving behind his attorneys and his $1 million bail and whatever remained of the life he had constructed on the California coast. The trial continued in his absence, which is legal under California law when a defendant voluntarily absents himself. The jury, having heard the survivor testimony, having watched the videotapes, having reviewed the full weight of the prosecution's case, deliberated and returned their verdict. On all 86 counts, Andrew Luster was found guilty. The judge sentenced him in absentia to 124 years in state prison. It was one of the longest sentences for sexual assault crimes in California history, and the man it was intended for was somewhere in Mexico. What followed is, in the annals of American true crime, genuinely strange. A fugitive manhunt that drew in one of the more flamboyant figures in the American cultural landscape, a man who had made a television career out of exactly this kind of pursuit. Dwayne Dogg. Chapman was a bounty hunter from Hawaii who had his own complicated legal history and a camera crew that seemed to follow him everywhere. He had been tracking Luster since the flight, working outside any official law enforcement capacity, following leads through the beach towns of Mexico's Pacific coast. In June of 2003, Chapman and his team located Andrew Luster in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. Chapman apprehended him, physically detained him on a street, and Mexican authorities were called. Luster was taken into custody by Mexican police, and Chapman and two members of his team were themselves briefly arrested by Mexican authorities on charges related to bounty hunting, which is illegal under Mexican law. Chapman eventually returned to the United States, where he faced his own legal proceedings that were ultimately resolved without conviction. Luster was extradited to the United States and returned to California to face the sentence that had been handed down in his absence. His attorneys appealed on various grounds, arguing, among other issues, that the trial should not have proceeded in absentia and challenging aspects of the conviction. The California Court of Appeal reviewed the case, and in the years that followed, made one significant modification. The sentence was ultimately adjusted to 50 years after appeal, though Luster remained in state custody. The convictions on the underlying counts were affirmed. The jury's findings stood. He had been found guilty of 86 counts of serious felony offenses. That did not change. As of the most recent publicly available reporting, Andrew Luster is serving his sentence in the California state prison system. He has been denied parole. The women whose testimonies built this case have, in the years since, spoken in various forums about what happened to them and about what it meant to be believed, finally, in a court of law, to have those videotapes shown to a jury, and to hear 12 people say, "We see what happened. We know what he did." The cosmetics empire his great-grandfather built has moved on, as corporations do. The Max Factor brand has changed hands and markets multiple times. The fortune that enabled Andrew Luster's lifestyle, the beach house, the freedom from employment, the social access, the very luxury that allowed him to believe consequences did not apply, was in the end not enough to escape the verdict. There is something worth sitting with in the particular nature of what those videotapes represented. He made them for himself, not to sell, not to share in any way that was documented, just to have, to keep, to revisit. Psychologists and legal experts who have discussed cases of this nature often note that recording such acts reflects a kind of supreme confidence in one's own untouchability, a belief, however diluted, that what you have done is your right, your privilege, your private domain, that the evidence will never matter because you will never be truly accountable. What Andrew Luster apparently did not account for was that those recordings would become the central instrument of his prosecution. The very tapes he kept became the testimony he could not cross-examine, the witness he could not discredit. They were simply there, on the screen, in a courtroom in Ventura County, and 12 jurors watched them and understood exactly what they were seeing. The women in this case did something extraordinarily difficult. They came forward about experiences that are among the most intimate violations a person can endure, knowing they would be questioned, knowing their credibility would be tested, knowing the defense would work to find inconsistency or motive or doubt. In the environment of the early 2000s, before the conversations that would come later in the decade and beyond about how sexual assault cases are handled, about how survivors are treated, about the particular cruelty of being disbelieved, in that environment, they came forward anyway. And the recordings meant that what they said was corroborated in the starkest possible terms. There is no clean resolution to offer here. The sentences handed down, however long, do not undo what was done. The years spent in courtrooms and in depositions, and in the long aftermath of what Luster allegedly did to these women, are years they cannot have back. What the legal system offered them was accountability, the specific, formal declaration by a jury of their peers that what happened to them happened, that it was wrong, that the person responsible has been found guilty and will be held to answer for it. For the survivors of Andrew Luster, that verdict in Ventura County in 2003 was not the end of anything, exactly. Trauma does not conclude on a jury's timeline, but it was something real and documented and true, a matter of public record that cannot be undone. Andrew Luster, heir to a glittering fortune, was convicted on 86 counts. He is in prison, and the cameras that he once thought were his alone to control ultimately told a story he could not escape. Our next case takes us to Oregon Coast I-5 Corridor, Oregon. There is a moment investigators remember, the kind that stays with you long after the case files are closed and the courtroom has gone quiet. It was the winter of 1981. And a detective named Dave Bishop was standing in a cramped office in Salem, Oregon, staring at a photograph of a knot, not a murder weapon, not a fingerprint, not a strand of hair under a microscope, a knot, a particular, distinctive, almost signature way that a length of cord had been looped and cinched around a victim's wrists. He had seen that knot before. He had seen it in another file from another town, another jurisdiction, another grieving family. And in that quiet moment, with the rain doing what Oregon rain does in January, everything began to pull together around a man who had once seemed, to all the world, like someone on the way up. Randy Woodfield grew up in the small coastal city of Coos Bay, Oregon, the kind of place where everybody knows your name and your mother and your little league record. By the time he was a young man, his name carried a particular shine to it. He was tall, broad-shouldered, naturally athletic, the sort of person people pointed to when they wanted to illustrate the possibilities of a small town. He played football at Portland State University and played it well enough that the Green Bay Packers selected him in the 1974 NFL Draft. That is not a small thing. That is the kind of accomplishment that gets a plaque in a high school hallway, that gets told and retold at holiday dinners, that becomes part of a community's mythology. For a time, Randy Woodfield was Coos Bay's favorite son. But the shine had already begun to tarnish before most people knew to look. Woodfield was cut from the Packers before ever playing a regular season game. There were other teams, brief stints, nothing that lasted. And alongside those failed football chapters ran a darker thread that the public would not learn about for years. He had prior arrests for indecent exposure dating back to the mid-1970s. A pattern of behavior that should have raised serious alarm, and in hindsight, would become a critical piece of his biographical context. He served time in the Oregon State Penitentiary for robbery and related offenses in the late 1970s, and it was after his release from that sentence, in the summer of 1979, that investigators would later determine the most serious crimes began. What happened along the Oregon coast and the Interstate 5 corridor between 1979 and early 1981 was piece by piece a long nightmare for the women who traveled those roads and worked in those businesses. The crimes followed a recognizable predatory pattern. A man would enter a business, a restaurant, a convenience store, a small roadside shop, typically near closing time, when staff were sparse and customers had thinned out. He would produce a weapon, force compliance, and commit robbery, sexual assault, and in the worst cases, murder. The victims were working women, young women, women going about the ordinary business of their lives. Among those lives, one stands as a focal point in the legal history of this case, though she was far from the only person hurt. Sherry Hull was 20 years old in January of 1981, a young woman working at a Godfather's Pizza restaurant in Beaverton, a suburb of Portland. She was the kind of person her friends described as warm and hardworking, someone who showed up, someone who cared about doing a good job. She had her whole future ahead of her, which is not a cliche when you are 20 years old. It is simply the truth. On the night of January 18th, 1981, Sherry Hull and a co-worker, Beth Wilmot, were closing up the restaurant when a man entered. According to court records and the account Beth Wilmot would give investigators, the man bound them, sexually assaulted them, and shot them both. Sherry Hull died. Beth Wilmot survived. Beth Wilmot's survival would become, in time, the fulcrum on which this entire investigation turned. But before that fulcrum was identified, investigators across multiple Oregon jurisdictions were working largely in the dark, each agency handling what appeared to be its own separate series of crimes. Lane County, Marion County, Douglas County, and others, each had pieces of what detectives did not yet know was a single puzzle. The Oregon State Police, recognizing the geographic spread and the similarities in method, began coordinating what would become a major multi-agency investigation. It was Detective Dave Bishop, working with the Oregon State Police, who took on the role of connector. The person who began pulling threads from different files and laying them side by side, the threads were real. The crimes shared consistent characteristics: the timing, the targeting of businesses near closing, the binding of victims, the use of a firearm. And then there was the knot. In multiple cases across multiple counties, victims had been bound in a particular way, with cordage tied in an unusual, consistent fashion. It was not a sailor's knot, or a standard square knot, or anything easily categorized. It was, investigators came to believe, the habitual work of a single pair of hands, the unconscious signature of someone who tied things a certain way because that was simply how they tied things. That detail, unglamorous and precise, would become one of the investigation's most important evidentiary threads. By early 1981, investigators had developed a general physical description of their suspect from various survivor accounts and witnesses. The man was described as tall, athletic, good-looking, and in some descriptions, disguised with a fake beard or mustache. A composite sketch was developed and circulated. Investigators working the case noted that the geographic spread of the crimes mapped closely to the Interstate 5 corridor, a long north-south highway running through the valley of western Oregon. Someone was moving along that road, stopping to commit crimes, and moving on. Law enforcement began referring to the unknown perpetrator as the I-5 Bandit. The name Randy Woodfield surfaced through a combination of investigative work that included canvassing, tip line calls, and the kind of methodical cross-referencing that detective work actually consists of, far less dramatic than television suggests, and far more labor-intensive. Woodfield's name came to Bishop's attention in part because of his prior criminal history and his physical description's alignment with witness accounts. When investigators looked more closely at Woodfield's movements and whereabouts during the period in question, they found reason to look harder. One of the critical investigative steps was re-interviewing Beth Wilmot. She had survived the attack at the Beaverton Godfather's Pizza. She had looked at the face of the man who killed her co-worker and shot her. When investigators showed her a photo array that included Randy Woodfield's photograph, according to court records and reporting on the trial, she identified him as the man who had been in that restaurant on the night of January 18th. That identification, from a woman who had survived the worst night of her life was devastating to the defense. But the case being built against Woodfield was not built on that identification alone. The physical evidence was also being assembled with care. Ballistic analysis was conducted on the weapon used in the Beaverton shooting. Investigators worked to trace the firearm. Evidence connecting Woodfield to the crime scene and to the broader pattern of I-5 corridor crimes was being documented and prepared. Prosecutors also had the testimony of individuals who knew Woodfield or had encountered him during the relevant period. And they had the geographical and circumstantial evidence tying him to multiple crime scenes across the state. Randy Woodfield was arrested in March of 1981. He was 30 years old. The arrest made immediate news in Oregon, in part because of the football background, in part because of the alleged scope of what investigators believed he had done. The charges against him were serious and multiple. Prosecutors charged him with the aggravated murder of Sherry Hull, along with assault and other charges related to the attack on Beth Wilmot and additional crimes. The trial took place in the spring and summer of 1981 in Marion County, Oregon, and it drew considerable public attention. Woodfield maintained his innocence. His defense challenged the eyewitness identification and the other evidence marshaled by prosecutors. But the jury, after hearing the testimony of Beth Wilmot, the ballistic and physical evidence, and the broader investigative picture assembled by the state, returned a verdict of guilty on the aggravated murder charge, along with guilty verdicts on multiple counts of assault and other serious offenses. The sentence handed down was not a modest one. Randy Woodfield received a life sentence for the aggravated murder of Sherry Hull, along with an additional 90 years for the other convictions. The judge was not leaving ambiguity about what the court intended for this man's future. In the years that followed, Woodfield's legal team pursued appeals through the Oregon appellate courts. The conviction was reviewed and ultimately upheld. The appellate record affirmed the evidentiary foundation upon which the jury had reached its verdict. The Oregon courts found no basis to overturn what 12 jurors had decided in that Marion County courtroom. Randy Woodfield has remained incarcerated in the Oregon State Prison System ever since his conviction. He has never been released, and given the nature and length of his sentence, release has never been a realistic prospect. He is in his early 70s now, a man who has spent more than 4 decades behind bars. The case against Woodfield, it should be said, did not resolve every question surrounding the crimes attributed to the I-5 bandit. Investigators over the years have sought to connect Woodfield to additional crimes beyond those for which he was charged and convicted, and the full scope of his alleged criminal activity has been the subject of ongoing examination by law enforcement and journalists. In 1984, journalist Ann Rule, already well known for her work chronicling the crimes of Ted Bundy, published a book examining Woodfield's case in detail. Rule's work brought national attention to the investigation and the trial, and it contributed to the public record surrounding this case in ways that remain part of its history. The question of precisely how many victims Woodfield had, across how many jurisdictions, has never been answered with complete legal certainty. What is certain is what the jury found and what the courts affirmed, that Randy Woodfield murdered Sherry Hull. There is something that should be said about the victims in this case, not in the aggregate, not as a count of offenses on a charging document, but as individuals. Beth Wilmot, who survived, who walked back into the hardest possible circumstances when she sat in a witness chair and faced the man prosecutors said had taken her co-worker's life and nearly taken hers as well. Her courage in that courtroom was a real thing. The survivors across the I-5 corridor who gave investigators descriptions, who sat through interviews and photo arrays and the exhausting, re-traumatizing process of cooperating with a criminal investigation, they were the ones who made it possible to build this case. And Sherry Hull, 20 years old, who went to work on a January night and did not come home, she deserves to be more than a data point. She was a daughter, a friend, a young woman in Beaverton, Oregon, with her whole life in front of her. The verdict in her name was the only justice the law could offer. It is not a complete answer to her loss, but it is the one the system had to give. The investigators in this case, the detectives who drove Oregon's highways and sat in small offices comparing files from different counties, who looked at knots and composite sketches and ballistic reports, who made phone calls and knocked on doors and followed the unglamorous, necessary path of methodical police work, they did what needed to be done. Dave Bishop and his colleagues did not have DNA technology or the digital investigative tools that modern law enforcement takes for granted. They had paper files, photographs, shoe leather, and careful attention to detail. That a case spread across so many jurisdictions, attributed to a suspect whose crimes ranged across hundreds of miles, was assembled into a conviction that held up through decades of appeals. That is no small thing. There is a particular quality to cases like this one. Cases where the perpetrator came from a background of apparent promise, where the distance between public persona and private reality was so vast. The former draft pick, the hometown hero, the man with the athletic build and the easy smile, and beneath all of that, the investigators allege, and the jury found, something else entirely. People want those cases to make sense, want there to be some visible warning that was missed, some obvious sign. The truth is usually more unsettling. The warning signs existed, in the form of Woodfield's prior criminal behavior, but the full picture only became clear in retrospect, as it so often does. Randy Woodfield is serving his sentence at an Oregon State Correctional Facility. He has never publicly acknowledged guilt for the crimes of which he was convicted. Sherry Hull's family has lived for over four decades with the knowledge of what happened to her and with whatever measure of resolution the guilty verdict provided. Beth Wilmot, who carried the weight of her testimony into that courtroom and faced what she faced in order to tell the truth, she went on. People do, somehow. They carry what they carry, and they go on. That is, in the end, what this story is about. Not the man whose name is on the charging document, though the law requires us to speak it. It is about the women who were targeted along those dark Oregon roads and in those late-night businesses, and about the ones who survived and the ones who did not, and about the investigators and prosecutors and jurors who made sure that the law had something to say about all of it, the knot, the survivor in the witness chair, the verdict that held. That is what the record shows, and that is what the record will say. Our next case takes us to Kenosha, Wisconsin. There is a letter. That is where this story truly begins, even though the letter was written before the end, written, in fact, by a woman who sensed, with a clarity that must have been both terrifying and clarifying, that something was very wrong in her own home. She sealed it, gave it to a neighbor, and asked that it be delivered to police if anything happened to her. It was, in its quiet way, an act of extraordinary courage, and it would take nearly a decade for that letter to do what she had hoped it would do. Julie Jensen was 36 years old in the winter of 1998. She and her husband, Mark, had been married for several years and lived in a tidy house in Kenosha, Wisconsin, a mid-sized city on the western shore of Lake Michigan, the kind of place where people mow their lawns on Saturday mornings and wave to neighbors across the fence. They had two young sons. Julie was, by every account from those who knew her, a devoted mother, the kind of woman who volunteered at school events, who remembered birthdays, who made her children feel that the world was fundamentally safe and good. She was warm. She was funny. She was, her friends would later say, the person you called when you needed someone to actually listen. She had also, in the months before her death, become frightened. Not loudly frightened, not in any way that the world around her necessarily saw, but quietly, deeply frightened in the manner of someone who has begun to understand something they wish they did not understand. She had confided in at least one neighbor that she was worried about her marriage, that she did not feel well, that things at home were not what they appeared to be. And then she sat down and wrote that letter. On December 3, 1998, Mark Jensen called 911. He told the dispatcher that he had come home to find his wife unresponsive. When paramedics arrived, Julie Jensen was unconscious and she was taken to a hospital. She never regained consciousness. She died 2 days later, on December 5th. She was 36 years old. Her boys were young enough that the world had not yet had time to show them how cruel it could be. The initial determination from the medical examiner was that Julie Jensen had died from a drug overdose. Specifically, a combination of diphenhydramine, the active ingredient in common sleep aids, and other substances. Investigators at the time looked at the circumstances and, given the apparent evidence of a deliberate ingestion of medication, began to consider the possibility that Julie had taken her own life. It was a conclusion that Mark Jensen, the grieving widower, did nothing to discourage. He spoke of his wife as a troubled woman. He suggested she had been depressed. But there was that letter. Julie's neighbor delivered it to police, as Julie had instructed. In it, and this is documented in court records and reported extensively throughout the subsequent legal proceedings, Julie Jensen wrote that she was not suicidal. She wrote that if anything happened to her, she believed her husband was responsible. She named Mark Jensen specifically. She asked police to look at him. She had written it in November 1998, weeks before her death, with the kind of terrible prescience that only makes sense in retrospect. For the moment, the investigation continued, but the case was not immediately pursued as a homicide. The medical examiner's initial findings leaned toward overdose, and without more, the case was not charged. Mark Jensen moved forward with his life. He began a relationship with a woman he had been corresponding with online, a relationship that, prosecutors would later argue in court, had been ongoing before Julie's death, conducted through the early internet of the late 1990s and constituting, in their telling, a powerful motive. He collected on life insurance policies. He remarried. Years passed. Julie's letter sat in police files. It was not until investigators returned to the case. And here's where the story takes on a different quality. The quality of justice arriving not swiftly, but slowly, deliberately, the way certain things of importance tend to arrive, that the full picture began to emerge. Kenosha police and prosecutors reopened the investigation and, crucially, arranged for additional forensic testing of tissue samples that had been preserved from Julie's autopsy. What those tests found changed everything. Forensic toxicologists examining the preserved samples detected the presence of ethylene glycol, the primary ingredient in antifreeze. It is a substance with a particular and sinister character in the annals of poisoning cases. It has a slightly sweet taste that can be masked in beverages. It is metabolized in the body in ways that can mimic other conditions, and in sufficient quantities over time, it causes organ failure. It is not a poison that announces itself. It is a poison that pretends. The toxicology findings indicated that Julie Jensen had not simply taken too many sleeping pills. She had been poisoned with ethylene glycol, and prosecutors would argue in court that this poisoning had been administered over a period of time, not in a single acute dose, but methodically, gradually, in a manner consistent with ongoing exposure rather than a single self-administered ingestion. The prosecution's theory, laid out carefully during trial, was that Mark Jensen had been introducing ethylene glycol into his wife's food or drink over the weeks and months before her death, slowly degrading her health, and that in her final days she had been given a fatal amount along with the diphenhydramine in what was staged to appear as a suicide by overdose. Mark Jensen was arrested in 2002. He was charged with first-degree intentional homicide. What followed was not a quick march to justice. It was, instead, a legal battle of considerable complexity, one that would ultimately reach the highest court in Wisconsin and touch on questions that go to the very heart of how American courts handle evidence. The central dispute was over that letter, Julie's letter. Defense attorneys argued that allowing Julie Jensen's letter into evidence, a letter written by a person who could not be cross-examined, a person who was dead, violated Mark Jensen's constitutional right to confront the witnesses against him. The Sixth Amendment's Confrontation Clause is one of the foundational protections of American criminal law. A defendant has the right to face his accusers. But Julie could not be called to the stand. She could not be questioned. Her words would simply be read to a jury, and the defense argued that this was fundamentally unfair. They had real legal authority on their side. They pointed to a 2004 United States Supreme Court ruling, Crawford v. Washington, which had significantly tightened the rules around so-called testimonial statements made outside of court. The prosecution countered with a doctrine known, with a certain grim appropriateness, as forfeiture by wrongdoing. The argument went like this: if a defendant has caused the unavailability of a witness through his own criminal conduct, if, in other words, he killed the person who might testify against him, then he cannot turn around and use that very unavailability as a shield. He has forfeited his right to confrontation by the act that silenced her. The courts would wrestle with this question for years. In 2007, the Wisconsin Supreme Court weighed in, ultimately finding that the letter could be admitted under the forfeiture by wrongdoing doctrine, though the exact legal contours of this ruling required careful parsing, and the case would continue to generate appellate questions. The legal proceedings stretched on in ways that tested everyone involved: Julie's family, who had waited nearly a decade already; the prosecution, who had built a case around evidence that defense attorneys challenged at every turn; and Mark Jensen, who maintained his innocence throughout. The trial that finally took place in early 2008 was, by any measure, a thorough examination of the evidence. Prosecutors laid out the forensic toxicology, the ethylene glycol in Julie's tissues, the expert testimony about how such poisoning works in the human body, the timeline of her declining health in the weeks before her death. They presented evidence of Mark Jensen's online relationship, arguing it provided motive. They introduced Julie's letter, that remarkable document in which she had, in essence, told the world from beyond her own death what she believed had happened to her. The defense attacked each piece. They challenged the toxicology, questioning the reliability of testing on preserved tissue samples held for years. They questioned whether the ethylene glycol findings were definitive. They argued that Julie had been depressed, that the evidence of a suicide was real. They argued that the letter was the product of a troubled woman's troubled mind, not a reliable account of reality. And they argued, again and again, that admitting that letter was a violation of fundamental rights. The jury listened to all of it. They deliberated. And on February 22, 2008, they returned a verdict: guilty of first-degree intentional homicide. Mark Jensen was sentenced to life in prison. He did not accept that verdict as the end of the matter. The appeals that followed were substantial, and they continued to focus on the central question that had animated the case almost from the beginning: that letter, and whether it should ever have been read to the jury. His attorneys pursued the constitutional argument through the appellate courts, and in 2011, a federal district court granted Jensen a new trial, finding that the admission of Julie's letter had violated his Sixth Amendment rights, a significant ruling that sent a jolt through the case. But that ruling did not hold. The state of Wisconsin appealed, and in subsequent years, the federal appellate courts reversed the decision, granting Jensen a new trial. The question of forfeiture by wrongdoing and its interaction with the Confrontation Clause continued to be litigated with care. The Wisconsin Supreme Court revisited the case. Ultimately, the conviction was upheld. The legal system, after years of careful examination of these profound constitutional questions, concluded that Mark Jensen's jury had reached the right verdict on properly admitted evidence. As of this writing, Mark Jensen remains incarcerated, serving a life sentence for the murder of his wife. He has maintained his innocence throughout his years of imprisonment. The appeals process has run its course through the available channels, and the conviction stands. There is a strange quality to this case that stays with you. It is not just the nature of the crime itself, though the deliberateness of it, the patience of it, the sustained intimacy required to poison someone you share a home and a bed and children with, is deeply unsettling in ways that are difficult to fully articulate. It is the letter. It is the fact that Julie Jensen, in the weeks before her death, found a way to reach forward through time and attempt to tell the truth about what was happening to her, even as she could not stop it, even as she must have understood that she might not be believed, that the letter might be ignored, that it might arrive too late or not at all. She was, in some ways, right about the timing. It did arrive too late to save her, but it arrived. And a neighbor honored her trust. and investigators eventually honored the evidence, and a jury honored the weight of what had been laid before them. The system moved slowly, agonizingly slowly, across a decade and more, but it moved. What endures most fully from this story, beyond the legal arguments and the forensic findings, is the portrait of a woman who knew, who was afraid, and who acted on that fear in the only way she could at that moment, which was to write down the truth and trust that someone, someday, would listen. Julie Jensen's boys grew up in the years that this case wound through the courts. They grew up without their mother, in the way that only certain kinds of grief allow, carrying an absence that is not simple or clean, but complicated by the circumstances of how she was lost. She has been gone since December of 1998. She was 36 years old, and she loved her children, and she was frightened, and she found a way to speak, even so. That is the thing that courts and lawyers and toxicologists and constitutional arguments cannot quite contain, the simple, stubborn courage of that letter, written by a woman who hoped she was wrong, who wrote it anyway, just in case she was right. That's three cases for today. From all of us at Intelligix, thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.